Welcome again to Artbeat. I'm Jeffrey Brown. The Man Booker Prize is given annually to a novel by an author in Britain, Ireland, or one of the Commonwealth nations. It is highly prestigious. It is often highly contentious and controversial. But this year, it's gone to one of Britain's leading writers, winning for his first time, Julian Barnes, for his novel, The Sense of an Ending. And Julian Barnes joins me now on the phone from London. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I guess before we get to the substance of the book, I should ask you if you're happy or relieved to win, especially after you made the shortlist three times in the past.
Yes, I think when my name was spoken, I think relief was the first emotion, and then afterwards pleasure.
Relief first.
Well, I'd been shortlisted three times before. I knew all the ins and outs of not winning the Booker Prize, and I just thought it would be good to know the ins and outs of winning it. And since then, it has been untrammeled pleasure, I must say.
It gets a lot of attention. In what ways is it important to you, as someone who's written a number of other books, won many other prizes?
It has a worldwide penetration, this prize, and that will mean, I hope, that people who haven't heard of me before will think, oh, I'll give him a go, might enjoy my work, and might discover that there are quite a number of books they can go back and look at.
Mm-hmm.
I've now written 20 books, so winning a prize at this stage of my life is not going to change either the way I write or my view of the world, but it might, and I hope it will, mean more readers.
Now, this book, the narrator is Tony Webster, a man in his 60s, who's lived by his own telling a fairly ordinary life, but then some things happen that make him want to look back. And I was thinking as I was reading it, it's a long view, but in a rather short book. Now, were you wanting to somehow explore a life, or rather how a life is perceived by the one living it? What were you aiming to do?
I wanted to write a book about time and memory, about what time does to memory, how it changes it, and what memory does to time. It's also a book about discovering at a certain point in your life that some key things that you've always believed were wrong. This is something that I started thinking about a few years ago, you know, and it's probably one of the preoccupations that you have as you age. You know, you have your own memories of life. You've got the story that you tell mainly to yourself about what your life has been. And then every so often, these certainties are knocked. Something happens. Someone reports something from 20 or 30 years ago, and you realize that what you believed is not the case. So I wanted to write about that. In terms of how much thematic matter there is and how comparatively short the book is, it's 150 pages, I think one of the things that happens as you mature as a writer is that you learn better how to handle time. If you look at those late Updike stories, I mean, Updike's a writer I revere. He's incredibly canny at dealing with a whole life in a short space of time. Alice Munro, the great Canadian short story writer, sure. She's another one. She can do in 30 pages enough to give you the sense of an entire life. My previous book was about 500 pages.
So you like the notion of paring down?
I do, yes. I'm one of those writers who started off writing novels and came to writing short stories later, partly because I didn't have the right ideas, partly because I think that short stories are more difficult. I think learning to write short stories also made me attracted towards a paring down of the novel form. But also, as I said, this is a novel about things that Tony Webster, without giving anything away, things that he doesn't know and can't find out. It's to do with holes in his memory and life and in reality that he can't pin down. And therefore, it's a short book for that reason as well. If it was a book about things he found out rather than things he couldn't find out,
right. It
might have been 250 pages.
The interesting part for the reader and the sort of mystery that you weave here is the reader's wondering, is the narrator telling us the truth, right? Does he remember things accurately, or is he revising history as you go?
That's the question we ought to ask ourselves in life, I think, though we rarely do, and I'm sure I'm as sinful as the rest of us in that respect, that, you know, we get to tell our stories, and then as we get older, the witnesses to our lives diminish, and so there are fewer people who actually can check or quarrel with our version of events. So if something comes along which puts your nose up against the wall of untruthfulness, that's part of what generates the energy and the action of the book.
Is that true for all of your work with what motivates you as a writer? Is it always some kind of, sort of almost philosophical questions as much as the sort of plot, the story that you want to tell?
It's equally important. You can't have a novel without real, believable people. And once you get into either too theoretical a novel or too philosophical a novel, you get into the dangers that the French novel has discovered in the last 50 or 60 years, and you get into a sort of aridity. No, you have to have real, identifiable people to whom the reader reacts in a way as if they were real people.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, obviously, I'm interested in such things as the difference between how we perceive the world and what the world turns out to be, the differences between the stories we tell others and the stories we tell ourselves. There's a wonderful Russian saying, which I use as the epigraph of one of my novels, which goes, "He lies like an eyewitness," which is very sly.
Which
and
is
clever
a good
and true.
Good for journalism as well, right?
It goes for journalism. It goes for witnesses in the law court. Yeah.
Sure, sure. I'm curious now because you were talking about short stories, and one thing I didn't know about you. I know your novels, but I didn't know until I was just reading about this prize. You wrote crime fiction under a pseudonym?
I did, yes. I've been a jack of all trades.
I didn't know that. And you wrote a collection on cooking, which I really
did. I did, yes. Actually, that sort of ties into what we were just talking about. It was called The Pedant in the Kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to cooking rather late. You know, I wasn't taught as a boy. So it was only in my early 20s I started cooking out of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the gap between what we're told is the case, a recipe, a glossy a photograph of what the dish looks like, and what actually comes out of our own kitchen that I'm interested in that book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You, it's like instructions for sex and what sex is really like. There's a gap there, and the fiction writer...
You're not writing on that next, are you?
I've done that on and off throughout my fiction.
All right.
I'm sure I'll come back to it again.
I know in the fiction, but not a manual.
I certainly wouldn't write a sex manual, no. I think I'd have to be down on my luck.
Finally, let me ask you, I want to come back to the Booker. There was the sort of a great fuss and uproar, I guess, over, especially in London, when the shortlist was announced and the questions about whether the prize was somehow being dumbed down in some sense, a focus on readability, I was reading, whatever that means. Of course, all put to rest by your victory. But tell us a little bit about the uproar there and what you make of the question of the awards.
Well, every year the jury changes. Every year there's a different group of people trying to read 140 novels in a very short space of time and trying to keep their wits intact and trying to keep their judgment intact. And at the same time, there's a group of, literary editors and literary experts who, without having read the 140 novels, decide that they know which ones are best.
Mm-hmm.
And so annually there's a sort of debate and an exchange of insults. And this time, one of the jurors said, it may have been the chairwoman, what we're looking for is readability. And everyone went off chasing that as if it was a word which meant dumbing down.
Mm-hmm.
Great books are readable anyway. Dickens is readable. Jane Austen is readable. John Updike's readable. Hawthorne's readable. It's a meaningless term.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go to the very extremes of literature, like Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, before you get a literary work that is literally unreadable.
Mm-hmm.
So it was used as a stick to beat the jury. And, you know, I deliberately didn't read the other entries, but they all sounded honourable to me. There were one or two books that were published, which I was frankly rather glad weren't on the shortlist, because your self-interest kicks in
of
at
course,
a certain point.
Yes.
But I think, you know, it's become traditional for there to be a good row at Booker time. And this one didn't really, it didn't do me any harm, so I welcomed it.
All right. Well, the very readable and Man Booker Prize-winning novel is The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. Thanks so much for talking to us. And again, congratulations.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us again on Artbeat. I'm Jeffrey Brown.